I'd like now to welcome to the program Scott M. Tyson. He is a scientist and technologist. He's author of the new book, The Unobservable Universe, a paradox-free framework for understanding the universe. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you very much, Mary Charlotte. I'm delighted to be here.
So let's talk for a moment about this book from the place where you start in the book, which is the questions that scientists have been asking since at least Aristotle. You make the statement that the really big questions haven't changed all that much over several millennia. What are the really big questions?
Well, back 2,500 years ago or so, as natural philosophers began observing their world, they started noticing some very peculiar aspects of the world and peculiar relationships between the perceptions that people have and the way in which the world operates. Ever since the time of the philosophers that preceded Socrates, the pre-Socratic philosophers who developed the concept of the atom and were known as the atomists, there were a number of paradoxes that emerged that resulted in the pre-Socratic philosophers wondering if reality and motion were, in fact, illusions. And many of the paradoxes that emerged as part of that dialogue remain
unresolved?
Unresolved nearly 3,000 years later. In fact, many of these paradoxes are coming back into the mainstream discussion today.
So let's talk about some of those paradoxes for a moment and why they're paradoxes. I mean, to the average observer driving their car to work, as they're perhaps doing right now, they're in a car that is in motion. And they're pretty sure that that motion is real. And if they go too fast, they might hit the car in front of them and so on. What's not to...
Well, I'd certainly say that two of the good arguments that motion is not an illusion have to do with increases in car insurance rates and stubbing a bruised toe. Those are two very convincing arguments that motion is real. But as part of the dialogue as to the nature of void versus the presence of matter, there were a number of discussions that were brought up by philosophers, including Leucippus, Democritus, Parmenides, and ultimately Socrates, that questioned whether or not motion was real, because there were a number of abstract logical arguments that were very effective in demonstrating that motion could very well be entirely an illusion. Not that we consider that today, but many of these paradoxes remain unresolved, and those were actually developed by Zeno of Elea in support of his mentor, Parmenides, in which he was trying to win an argument with Democritus, and Socrates intervened. And Socrates found in favor of Parmenides, partly because of the paradoxes against motion that Zeno had developed for this debate. And it was at that moment that Socrates uttered a statement that's become a very well-known phrase today, which is that nature abhors a vacuum. That's where that phrase actually comes from.
So would you like to explain, would it be fruitful to explain the most important, what you might consider the most important unresolved paradox to us right now as it relates to your work?
There are a number of paradoxes. With the emergence of each school of physics, what happens is a number of paradoxes start being observed. So in the history of mankind, there have been only three schools of physics, the first being what emerged from Aristotle when he wrote his book entitled simply The Physics, which was really more about metaphysics. Then nearly 2,000 years later, with the emergence of Newton and Newton's laws of motion, and then nearly 250 years after that, the third school of physics involving Einsteinian relativity and quantum physics.
The second one, if I may say so, and as you do say, being the one that pretty much guides our daily lives, gets us to the moon, gets our bicycles working, gets our houses built, etc.
That's right. Newtonian physics. Each of these physics believed they were provided a thorough description of the universe and represented the final word on physics. So far the world has in fact encountered three final words on physics, and with the establishment of each of these schools of physics, philosophers and scientists who are observing the world begin observing new paradoxes. And we have to remember that the universe itself is not paradoxical. The universe exists, and we can attempt to understand it, but the universe isn't paradoxical. Paradoxes emerge from an incomplete or flawed understanding of the way in which the universe operates. So there's only one place where paradoxes involving the universe actually exist, if you can use the word exist, and that's within the mind of observers. So with each of these schools of physics, new paradoxes begin emerging. With the establishment of relativity and quantum physics in the 20th century, a number of paradoxes began emerging shortly after the emergence of those schools of physics. And the number of paradoxes that have emerged over the past 10 years has grown substantially and include a number of things that people may be familiar with, such as dark energy, dark matter, the concept of the Big Bang, and what might have preceded the Big Bang. How our universe is not only expanding, but how it's expanding at a faster rate. And, by the way, what is the universe expanding into? So all of these represent paradoxes that are unresolved.
Well, how can an infinite thing expand?
In my book, I refute the very concept of infinite. Infinity is a concept. I don't refute that the concept of infinity exists. I refute that infinity is actually is part and parcel of the universe in any way. Things can be exceedingly large, and our human mind is very, very limited in terms of the quantities that it can really comprehend. And when we really think about what those quantities are, there are some thought exercises that demonstrate that really the largest number that the human mind can fully embrace, fully get its arm around in a meaningful way and still not lose the meaning of that quantity is a number between 5 and 20. So when we start talking
that
about...
That can't be true.
No, it is true, and I'd be delighted to go through an exercise.
I mean, you can look at a group of 50 people. You can go to a stadium. I mean, you understand those numbers.
Right, and you know what the number is, but you can't look out at that large group of people and say, looking at that picture, I can tell you that the number of people in that stadium is 42,391. You just know when you look out there that you see a large number of people, and someone will give you statistics, and you'll say, yeah, I suppose that sounds pretty reasonable. But if instead you went through an exercise whereby you closed your eyes and imagined a whiteboard in your mind, and you thought of some simple object like a ball or a pen, that as you start increasing that quantity one at a time, that you begin to see that your mind starts organizing that into numbers that you can embrace more easily. For instance, as you go from 1, you'll probably see just 1 in the center of your mind's whiteboard. If you go to 2, you see either 2 in a row or 2 in a column. You go to 3, that might still be in a row, but your mind may start organizing that in so that each object occupies the corner of a triangle. By 4, you're likely putting those objects on the corner of a square. And as we get up to higher numbers, 5, 6. With 6, most people begin collapsing that visualization problem down to 2 rows of 3, because we have trouble even at 6 visualizing those as discrete items. By the time you get to larger numbers like 16, you might see 4 vague clumps of objects in your mind, and then you can sort of zoom in and see that each clump is comprised of 4 items, but actually being able to visualize simultaneously 16 items exceeds the capability of most human minds.
Yeah, many, but I mean, there are physicists who can who understand 32-dimensional reality, and then there are some of us who barely understand three and are kind of bumbling through it. And then there are some of those idiot savants who, I mean, there was a thing in Oliver Sacks where the guy, somebody spills a box of matches and they looked at it and saw 111, and that's how many it was. I mean, there's every capability out there.
That's right. There's a very wide spectrum. But the typical human mind has difficulty visualizing numbers greater than 15 or 20. The point is that when we're talking about the nature of the universe, we're really talking about astronomically huge numbers or vanishingly small numbers, and we can conceptualize those in terms of how many decimal places they have. But truly being able to understand the mathematics involved of these huge or vanishingly small numbers is very much a challenge for people. Routinely in my work, as an engineer and scientist, I work with these numbers. But let me give you...
So let's go back to the paradoxes.
Okay.
How about we go with Zeno?
That's an excellent place to start. So let me describe Zeno's paradox involving the archer. So I'm going to set up a little bit of a scenario for your listeners. So I hope I can provide a good description here of what's happening. You have an archer, and he's got his bow and his arrow, and he's pulling the arrow back and aiming it at a target at some distance. And you, as the observer, are standing off to the side. The archer lets his arrow go, and it starts racing through the air toward the target. Now, what the observer is going to do is to break down that travel of the arrow into vanishingly small moments of time using a camera that, let's say, has an incredibly fast shutter speed. And if you take a
picture... Zeno had cameras?
Well, he had the notion of taking a snapshot.
Of breaking it down. Okay, go ahead.
He actually had the notion of taking a mental image at a motion in time. I'm sure we'd be much further with the paradox if Zeno, in fact, had a high-speed digital
right.
camera. So let's take the arrow in the center of its flight, and you're, again, standing off to the side. And if you took a picture representing a moment in time, you'd see that arrow stationary, motionless, and sharp in the picture against a stationary, motionless, and sharp background. And so then here's the question that Zeno introduces. Zeno says, if the motion of the arrow can be represented at any point in time by a stationary arrow, by it being completely stationary, then how was it that the arrow moved from where it was to where it now is, and then how does it move from where it now is to where it will next be, and so on and so forth until the arrow strikes the target. So the notion captured in this paradox is that there's something that we don't understand about the nature of motion if the problem can in fact be accurately depicted as a series of moments in time and snapshots, and that there are discrete moments in time and discrete moments in space, then...
But who says it can? I mean, who says that a motion is discontinuous and is a series of points rather than a smooth motion?
Actually, there's a spectrum of thought out there right now. You'll find a number of scientists who believe that reality consists of continuous space and time, and you'll find scientists who believe that space and time can be broken up into discrete points. And in fact, the basis of much about the theory known as string theory or supersymmetric string theory or M theory is the fact that there are discrete points in space at which dimensions are so tightly wrapped up that we can't observe them. So these are the types of questions that emerge first with Zeno as he was trying to instruct us that we're not capturing the full spectrum of observations that are possible in order to fully understand motion. And those give rise, in fact, to many of, or are intimately related to the paradoxes that we know today.
So Your book is called The Unobservable Universe, a paradox-free framework for understanding the universe. I mean, that's a gigantic claim. Take us, because we do not have the next 7 hours on the radio here to go through the book.
You're already getting to know me.
Cut to your hypothesis, to the point of your book, from Zeno to this whole question of the observer, the observable universe, the unobservable universe.
That's a pretty big question. Let me first state that, yes, the subtitle of the book, Providing a Framework for a Paradox-Free Universe, is in fact a big and bold claim, but one that I feel that I for which I provide a well-defended and well-presented case. And I certainly encourage people to engage me in discussion if they feel otherwise.
Which they can do this Saturday.
That's
at
right.
Garcia Street Books
bring
at 2 in the afternoon.
You've got a few days now to prepare those tough questions, so I hope you'll bring them with you. So what I did in my book, actually the book didn't turn out as I had initially planned. Initially, I intended to write a book that described a new philosophical framework by which you could separate real scientific truth from flawed and incomplete scientific interpretations. And part of the work I did was to survey, to inventory all those paradoxes that we know about the universe that have emerged over the past 3,000 years and break them down to their basic thoughts, their basic memes. And when I did that, I discovered that every paradox, new and old, appeared to be intimately related to every other paradox through the same few characteristics, through the same basic thought patterns. And that sort of pointed to where there might have been errors and misinterpretations that science continues to inadvertently embrace as truth. As I continue...
But hang on. Can we just stop for a second?
Sure.
Because as I understand science, not being a scientist, you never get to any final truth. There's always the best thinking at this time, and you build on that, but you never reach the end.
Well, in fact, that's actually a very important lesson that an Indian philosopher from the second century, Nagarjuna, proposed, that any attempt to subscribe to a particular understanding or doctrine was to exclude the possibility of there being more understanding, and therefore adhering to any particular belief structure would prevent you from further growing and understanding more about the universe. And the suggestions I make in my book relate to the fact that that I propose that there were not that many, only a small handful, of mistakes made by physics and philosophy over the past 2,500 years or so. And once those are corrected, we watch it wouldn't be correct to say the paradoxes go away. It would be more correct to say that none of the paradoxes of which we're aware emerge. They're nowhere to be seen.
So what are those, if you can make this question comprehensible to our friends listening out in radio land right now, what are those mistakes?
Well, the three mistakes relate to the nature of void, the nature of mass and its relationship with matter and gravity. Listeners may or may not be aware of the fact that the biggest science experiment on the planet right now, the Large Hadron Collider over on the Swiss-French border, is a $10 billion experiment to try and get to the bottom of mass. It's my prediction that the basis for mass, the hypothesized Higgs boson, is not going to be discovered because there's a misunderstanding that science continues to embrace with regard to mass, matter, and gravity. And the third element is a little bit more obscure and has to do with Einstein's assertion as part of quantum mechanics, that the only objective reality is that which can be revealed through measurement. There's a little bit of a tweak that's necessary. Now, although those three mistakes have sweeping consequences, what I find to be the more interesting part of the story, and the reason that I didn't publish the book until I could answer this question, was why those three mistakes? What is it about the human experience, about the human condition, that that fostered those three mistakes being made as opposed to any others. And that's actually, I find in many ways, the more interesting part of the story, because it shows a dichotomy between the full suite of observations that people have been taking, that they've been lumped in a way that may not be correct, and that there's a distinction that should be made, and that I make in my book between class one and class two observations. And even that assertion about the observations is sufficient to eliminate the paradoxes with which we've been grappling in some cases for millennia.
What are class one and class two observations?
Well, those require probably more discussion than
that
the amount
of time we can do in the next 4 minutes.
You wanted me to avoid going for 7 hours. Answering that in 4 minutes may be a bit challenging. But it does have to do with the nature of observation and the fundamental forces that are directly involved in the in human perception. And when we analyze those forces and our observational relationship with them, we find that observations that have been clumped together should no longer be clumped together, and that there's actually a distinction. I think it might be advisable, if people want a thorough understanding of that, it's treated in great depth in the book, but it is a bit difficult to cover succinctly right now.
We're talking to Scott M. Tyson about his book, The Unobservable Universe. So at least give us a clue about the title. We've been talking a lot about paradox, but what do you mean by observable versus unobservable?
For every particle of matter in the universe, volumetrically, there are, and I'm just rounding, because it's a big number, we can round. Remember, it's hard to embrace a number bigger than 20 anyway. For every particle of matter, there exist about 1,000 trillion parts of empty space. And so the vast majority of the universe is void. And the one major characteristic of void is that it's unobservable. So this is a treatment of issues relating to observable phenomenon and their relationship to the void. And the void is sort of the central character within the book.
In your book, you talk about this moment in your own life where you read a book called Biocentrism by Dr. Robert Lanza, and you read it in order to refute it because you thought it was going to be a bunch of New Age, I call it New Age, New Age nonsense. And it had a huge impression on you, and it was one of the catalysts that got you going on what has resulted in your book. Tell us about that.
Your description was very, very accurate. In fact, I wanted to read the book so that I could refute it as a good physicist was supposed to do. This was a book on the nature of the universe by essentially a biologist. And I was so embarrassed at the prospect of even being seen buying the book that this was when I made the transition to e-books so that I could download it in the privacy of my home and no one would see me carrying the book over to the cashier. So as much as I wanted to refute the concept of the book, Dr. Robert Lanza did an excellent job of framing questions in new ways, guiding the reader through questions that have been asked for quite some time, but asking them in refreshing new ways that really got me thinking. And the impact of reading the book was profound on me. In fact, it really provided the missing pieces of the puzzle that I needed. I'd been stymied for 34 years of thought experiments about how to get past the point that I got to. And the key was the new types of thinking that Dr. Lanza had introduced in his book. And essentially, one of those things was that he made it abundantly clear. You know, we tend to think of time and space as being properties of the universe. And yet it was Einstein who showed through his theories of relativity that space and time depend in some way on the observer and the observer's motion through the universe. So even though Einstein made that point, it really didn't sink home in my mind until I read Dr. Lanz's framing of it. And what becomes abundantly clear, and is a bit difficult to embrace at first, is that in some way the concept of space and time are represent shared characteristics between the universe and the observer. They're neither the exclusive property of the universe nor the exclusive property of the observer. And that really set off a light bulb in my mind.
And if I may say so, the human observer, because our sense of time is based on our lifespan and all sorts of things that are basically part of our biological equipment.
Right, and of course there are no peer-reviewed journals or articles put out by anything but the human community, so we're limited to our analysis of that literature.
Yeah, but I mean, biocentrism is really human-centrism, ultimately.
Well, in a way. It provides the concept that our view of the universe relies very heavily on the nature of our sensory organs and the portion of the spectrum of all possible parts of the universe that we can observe. In other words, we as humans only observe a very small fraction of the full acoustic spectrum, and we also observe a strikingly small portion of the electromagnetic or light spectrum. We can only observe a very small spectrum of pressures and touch before we start experiencing pain or damage. So our observational relationship with the universe really represents a very small portion of the full spectrum of possibilities.
You've been working... I mean, you're a Johns Hopkins trained scientist. You work in science and technology and semiconductors and things like that. Have you run your ideas past, you know, Santa Fe Institute, Lanl types? I mean, you're the people who are in the so-called establishment of the type of work that the establishment of the people who were doing particle physics, astrophysics, stuff like that?
Actually, with the work that I've done as an advisor to the Office of the Secretary of Defense and as a researcher with Sandia, as well as with Johns Hopkins University Applied Physics Lab, I have a number of peers, and I've provided the book to others to read. And it's very interesting because the book has been met with two radically different responses. And unfortunately, it seems as though each group seems irritated at me with the topics in the book. So there's the group that gets to the part of the book where I start introducing some of the mistakes that Einstein made, and at that point some of the people get very indignant, as though they behave in a way that I describe as you're calling my God stupid, and they don't want to engage any further, and they in fact don't finish reading the book. That group has actually grown smaller. The other group is the group of physicists who call me up and begin the conversations saying, I am so aggravated with you, I don't even know where to begin. And I say, well, gee, I'm sorry. What are you upset about? And they say, well, I've spent my entire career with the romantic notion that I was going to be the one to overcome these paradoxes and provide new insight into the operation of the universe, but it looks like you've done it, and now I can't do it.
So half of them buy it, half of them don't, is what you're saying.
Half of them totally buy it, and half of them totally don't.
The book is called The Unobservable Universe, A Paradox-Free Framework for Understanding the Universe. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you very much.